Right, kids. Hello and welcome to episode number 61, maybe, or something else, of Fitness Unfiltered. Today I am joined by my usual co-hosts. Dan, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you for asking.
And Emma, how are you?
I'm also fine, thank you.
And we are absolutely delighted, and I wrote in my plan super excited, which rhymes with delighted, to have the excellent Dr. Nikki Stamp with us today. I first discovered Nikki on Hazel Wallace's Food Medic podcast. She is a cardiothoracic surgeon, but she's not only a cardiothoracic surgeon. She's one of only 11 female heart surgeons in the whole of Australia. And she's recently released her second book, Pretty Unhealthy, which I have recently read. And we are very excited to talk about that today. Nikki, how are you?
Hello, I'm also fine because that's how we are around here. Yes, everything is good. It's toasty warm down here, but everything is good. Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You're most welcome. Thanks for joining us. And I'm pleased that you passed the first Fitness Unfiltered test, which was the question, how are you? So that's pretty exciting. So tell us a little bit about yourself. Obviously we all know who you are, but some of our listeners might not know yet. They will do very soon. So tell us a bit about yourself and your background.
Well, as you can hear, I'm Australian. I'm very Australian, in fact. And I am a heart and lung surgeon or cardiothoracic surgeon. And I specialize in adult, predominantly cardiac disease, women's heart disease, transplant, and I'm also currently a PhD candidate, and I'm looking at ways to get people to be more physically active after they've had cardiac surgery. And because I don't have any other free time, I also, I'm a writer. I've written two books. And the most recent one was just released a couple of weeks ago in the UK. And I also hang out on TV every now and again, hosting TV shows and occasionally I sleep as well.
I mean, I was going to say, is that all? Because we're quite used to people being high achievers on this podcast. So is that all you've got to tell us, or is there anything else?
I think that's about it. I think that's me in a nutshell.
Amazing.
If I think of anything.
Yeah, no, if you think of anything else, just let us know. But so, like, just touch on again, like, because again, this is something that you spoke out about quite a lot on Hazel's podcast, and something that I found really interesting. But in terms of, like, your career and your profession, like, it's pretty unusual to get many female surgeons, but then cardiothoracic surgeons, again, even less usual. Tell us a bit about kind of what led you into that career path and what kind of struggles you've encountered. I know that's probably a whole podcast on its own.
It is. It's a huge, huge topic in and of itself. So I was always going to be a surgeon. I love that kind of immediacy that you get from what I do. So someone comes to me and they have an illness and then they get an operation and they don't, or they have pain or something like that, and it goes away. It's not that easy, obviously, but I like that kind of, you see the direct results of what you've done straight away. So it was never a question. I think I didn't realize until I was much older, I was clearly naive, that it was unusual for women. There are around, in the UK, US and Australia, it's very similar. So about 10 to 12% of all surgeons across the board are female, mm-hmm. and cardiothoracics, it's somewhere between 4 to 6%, depending on your country. I don't want to be completely pessimistic. It really depends on the day you catch me on as to how pessimistic I'm going to be. It is a bit more difficult. I certainly have heard things and had things happen to me or witnessed things that my male colleagues would never, ever experience. Sexual harassment and worse. Patients don't think I'm the doctor. They ask to see guys rather than me, all those kinds of things. But I think one of the really good things about my job of being, I suppose, in a relative minority, because obviously not a minority, half the population, but I think one of the really good things for me is that it's really led to an interest in women's health and women's heart mm-hmm. disease specifically. So I think that for me, all of those sort of difficult times make it worthwhile that I've found a niche. And I've also found a really, really good community in that there are a lot of other female surgeons or women in, you know, many, many different walks of life who really appreciate that kind of camaraderie that you get from someone else in a perhaps similar situation.
Cool. I mean, that sounds amazing and such a like an in-depth sort of career process that kind of in the images that we then conjure up from somebody who's had to work that hard in their career and to be so driven in kind of obtaining a surgical career would kind of give us ideas that are perhaps not at odds with, but maybe if we imagined what the social media would look like and what the books would look like of somebody who's been through that career pathway, we might not perhaps expect what we see from you, which is kind of almost, you know, although it's all really relevant to your work and, you know, the lifestyle stuff and things like that, there's a much heavier focus on kind of the wider picture that we might expect than we might expect from somebody who's like a specialized surgeon. And like, tell us a bit about how you became interested in that wider context and thinking about health versus image. And also, like, I'm interested to know a little bit about how your professional role kind of interacts with your wider role as, you know, and I'm using the word health influencer, and I'm being a little bit sick in my mouth while I'm saying it, because I know nobody likes to be thought of as that. But what I mean is, you know, you're discussing health on a wider scale with the general public, not just with your colleagues and with your patients directly. So I'm really keen to hear more about that.
So I think that one of the things about my specialty is that a lot of people who have cardiac surgery have, you know, a huge list of comorbidities of other illnesses or other issues. So not just health related issues, not just physical health, but mental health, you know, social issues, all those kinds of things. So really for me to stay focused on one small aspect of my job, i.e. the surgery, I think it's really doing a bit of a half-assed job, to be honest. I think not thinking about health in a broader context, mm-hmm. is not really appropriate. And so I think that's kind of what led me down that pathway. But I kind of fell into this other, I call it my second job, sort of by accident a few years ago when I started writing. I'm not 100% sure why I did, and then that sort of grew into contributing for Huffington Post, which grew into, you know, books and TV and all these other things. And I think as I started to put ideas out there, whether, you know, it be on paper or on TV or whatever, is that it got me in, unfortunately, that influencer space. Not I'm not calling myself an influencer, but I'm kind of aware of what other information is out there, what mm-hmm. people are being told. And also I'm starting to see a lot more of this at work. I'm starting to see a lot more people come with questions or information or other things that they've seen online or, you know, in a magazine or by, you know, someone who has a million followers. Mm-hmm. That I'm starting to see that quite a bit more often. And not all of it is good. So I think that, you know, for me, this kind of other side of my job is a natural extension. It's obviously very broad. It's sort of, in some circumstances, it steers away into, you know, areas that are, you know, as you say, I would never expect a heart surgeon to be to be dabbling in. And it's also, you know, it's kind of led me back to my academic practice, in that, you know, some of the research that I've done and people I've spoken to, particularly for this second book, actually led me down the pathway of doing a PhD. And other research projects with some of the experts I spoke to for that. So mm-hmm. I think for me, health just doesn't occur in isolation, and you know, being in amongst all this kind of space has really cemented that for me.
Awesome. Was it that frustration with misinformation that led you, initially prompted you to putting a little bit more out as well, Nikki?
I think so, and I think there is a lot of misinformation, and like I said, I'm certainly seeing it a lot more often at work, and I hear it amongst my friends as well. I hear it, you know, my mum is like the worst offender. Sometimes she'll be like, you know, oh, you shouldn't eat this or do this. Or she was talking about epidurals to my sister-in-law recently because, you know, they're bad, or something's bad or something's good. And it's starting to hear it a lot more often, and it is really frustrating. It does have consequences. I'm not a big sort of, you know, name and shamer, with a couple of notable exceptions, because I just don't, you know, if there's enough negativity online, you know, yeah, that, you know, you don't need to necessarily be pointing the finger. And I think also some people are genuinely trying to do good, execution poor. But, you know, I think that there are times when people should be called out, but really I think it's actually more important to contribute to a more positive discourse around health.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. And I think one of the things that you've done quite well in the very well in the book was your kind of discussion about how like we as health professionals are just as much at risk of that misinformation, like, because we think, we kind of feel like we've got this force field around us, because like I know I've had issues in the past where I've been like, oh, I'm a doctor, so I have this automatic assumption that I know stuff, and so then when somebody tells me that if I don't eat for longer than 3 hours it's going to slow down my metabolism and stop me from losing weight because they, you know, they are a personal trainer or whatever, then I'm going to go, oh really? And, you know, literally just as much at risk of totally falling for this stuff as everybody else, especially when, you know, when they dress it up with all this, all the kind of pseudoscience that they do, like, oh, you know, the thing is, we're not evolved to be able to eat wheat as well as we think we can, and that's why it makes us more overweight than everything else. Like, why do you think that, and I sort of half answered my own question, but why do you think that, that even though we're supposedly quite well educated, why do you think we're still at risk, and why do you think we are also sometimes easy to fool, to the point that lots of health professionals themselves often put out some quite questionable information on social media, etc.?
Yes, they do. Anyway, we'll leave that. I think everybody is prone to what is essentially, you know, marketing in some cases. It's cognitive error. We all have the same processes. We all want the same things. You know, we want to be healthy or good looking or rich or popular, all these kinds of things. And those kinds of messages really tap into those insecurities. You know, and I think one of the errors that we make is that anyone who falls for pseudoscience or bad messages or, you know, stupid diets or stupid exercise programs or whatever it is, that they mustn't be very smart. And I think that's a big error. I think it's kind of insulting to people, for one thing.
Absolutely.
You know, it's not really a great way to try and turn the tide, so to speak. But I don't think intelligence necessarily has anything to do with it. You know, Arthur Conan Doyle, who wrote Sherlock Holmes, right, the greatest analytic mind, fictional, but, you know, he was a physician, he was a doctor, he believed in fairies, for God's sakes. Mm-hmm. You know, so nobody is immune to funny messages or misinformation. And I think the sooner we start to think, oh, listen, this is not about how intelligent you are or are not, that's when we might be able to sort of unravel some of those messages.
And I think that's been part of the problem, because a lot of the times I think when you see professionals try and myth bust, it can be quite condescending, and it can sometimes appear like they're not calling out the people that are giving out the bad information. They're calling out the people who are believing it and making them feel like they're stupid and they've done something wrong, and, you know, people who use whatever, you know, are wrong. And actually, no, it's really difficult to get that kind of message across, I think, without making people feel bad about themselves, which is probably the most important thing not to do.
No, agree.
I think like in the book, obviously, you talk quite a lot about your own health experiences and how you had made assumptions about your own health as well, like that, because based on your size and being, you know, in a smaller body, etc., when, even though you were experiencing like high blood pressure, high sugar levels, you assumed that you were healthy just because of your size. What kind of, tell us a little bit about that and about that attitude and how, like, I think it's something we've all got a bias towards, but I think what often gets spoken about is how it can have a negative impact on overweight people. or people in larger bodies. And also what I'd like to talk about is how it can also have an impact the opposite way as well, how we can actually discriminate against people who look healthy, or what we perceive healthy to look like.
Absolutely. So the story was, I'd sort of started thinking about the second book at this stage, and that this sort of obsession with looking healthy was sort of misleading us. Like, we think that we've got a gym membership and activewear and a green smoothie, and we look and we're a small size or whatever, that we're healthy. Then I went to my GP, and I'd been feeling really tired, and my blood pressure was high. High blood ones in my family. I've actually done quite well to make it this far without needing any treatment for it. And we also did a whole bunch of other blood tests as well, including checking my sugar. My GP is like texting me my results, which I should say is not usual practice. It's because doctor patient. Yeah, sure. Yeah, just sort of, just be like, it would not be done, but I'm maybe you should do that. Maybe you should treat me like everybody else. But anyway, I got the text message to say, listen, your blood sugar's a bit high. And I was in a change room. I was buying a dress. And I was like, this is ridiculous. The first thing I reached for just really automatically was that, well, I'm really small. I'm not overweight. I'm clearly healthy. It's not right. And then the logical part of me kicked in and was like, no, that's not true. You've been skipping out on running training. You've been working too much. You've been, eating out a lot. All these kinds of things, these behaviours. And then, of course, the concrete evidence from these blood tests, from my blood pressure and all the rest of it, which were saying that's not true. And I think that was the moment where it all kind of tied together for me, is that we're too quick to be, you look okay, either to each other, to celebrities, to ourselves. I certainly see it at work. We would probably look at someone who is, relatively slim and fit with a little bit of surprise if they have an illness, such as a cardiac illness. And again, it's not correct thinking. You can't tell a lot. You can tell some things, but you can't really tell a lot with any great accuracy as to what someone's health is like, mm-hmm. Just by looking at them.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think what we underestimate is that we're forgetting to ask questions, like, especially like in sort of my pathway in general practice. We see it's very easy to assume people are healthy and not ask them if they're smokers, not ask them if they use recreational drugs, how much they're drinking, etc. Whereas when we see people that come in with health problems and they're overweight, it's very easy to it's got this, it's kind of this visual representation that is causing us, I think, to not see the wood for the trees, or to see too much of it, etc. So, sorry, did someone say something? No, I just misunderstood. So let's talk about BMI as a measure of health, because this kind of leads on quite well into that. But also, you touch on metabolically healthy obesity, as it's sometimes called, in the book. We often hear a lot about people who are very fit despite being obese on the BMI scale, and what that health means. But you talk a little bit more about the evidence for that and the implications of that in the book. So tell us a little bit. I mean, I don't want to give away your book to all of our readers. There's a lot more in the book, by the way, listeners. So our readers,
did I call them our readers? Just read the book. No, so BMI, body mass index, is really coming under fire a bit at the moment, for its inaccuracies. And I think some of those concerns are founded. So what it does is it takes your height and weight, and gives you an index, a number, and classifies you into categories. Underweight, normal weight, overweight, obese, etc., based on that number. So it has some limitations. It's not always an accurate marker of your health. partly because if I look at that number in an individual, it may not be correct for that patient, that person's population or their body build, all those kinds of things. It doesn't, again, as I've sort of alluded to, weight and your body shape, your body type, etc., is a very it's a very crude measure of health. Weight can 100% contribute to your health and well-being, and that's at both ends of the spectrum, we should say. But it's not the only thing that will contribute to your health. So putting a lot of stock in BMI sort of has similar issues. That being said, as a population tool, so if we look at, thousands, hundreds of thousands of people, BMI does have some evidence to show that, with changes in BMI, again, at either end of that scale, does have some associations with health. So I think the tendency to sort of throw the baby out with the bathwater and say BMI is universally bad is not necessarily correct. But like any tool, if it's not used correctly, then yes, it is going to give you bad information. You put junk in, you're going to get junk out. I think we've got to be a bit cautious with this sort of dichotomy that's happening at the moment around this. And I have to be honest, this kind of question, where what's right, what's wrong, where is the truth is one of the things that I really, really struggled with writing this book, because there's a lot of conflicting science. And there are days where I'm like, no, BMI is awful. It should be banned. It is the worst thing ever. And other days where I'm like, no, that's completely, that's very correct. So I think that, that when that's the case, it means that the truth kind of lies somewhere in between. And it's, again, what you do with this science, with this information, with these tools that actually matters.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think that's, it's the absolutism that is often, I think, leads us down these wrong paths. It's that we know a little bit about something and we know some of the science, so therefore we're like, okay, well, that's it then. This study says this, so that's where it is. And then actually, like one of the things that I think you go into quite a lot of depth on in the book is the skewing of complex health messages for that reason. And you talk about, one of my favorite examples was saying how like an apple a day keeps the doctor away, and actually there is actual data that suggests that people who have apples daily, Emma Story Gordon, have better health markers, and that's just likely to be due to the fact that daily consumption of fruit suggests that they're generally engaging in other health type behaviours as well. So it's likely that they're having other beneficial eating patterns and generally being healthier, not necessarily specifically about the apple itself. And so instead of people saying, okay, like eat more fruit and vegetables, we end up getting eat more of this specific vegetable. It should be sourced this way, it should be cooked this way, and this is how much of it you should have every day, etc. And it becomes like a medicine instead of just like eating. And so we've turned an apple a day keeps the doctor away. This is the quote from the book. We've turned an apple a day and keeps the doctor away into apples.
Sorry, can you do that in an Australian accent?
I've got this. Okay.
I'm going to be judgy, so you know.
That's fine. I would expect nothing less.
I think that's fair.
So we've turned an apple a day into apples contain flavonoids which fight cancer.
I thought that was quite good.
That wasn't bad at all.
It was brilliant.
Bad.
I'm brilliant at accents.
Yes. It's quite bogan, which is like, quite sort of, like chav, I think is.
Yeah, I'm cool with that. That's what if I was gonna do Australian, I would have to go like into that
bogan
for sure. So yeah, total bogan.
Yeah.
So I was gonna say that is the message that we've turned it into kind of apples are containing ingredients that fight cancer rather than saying that apples are good for you. And like, tell us a bit more about this and the whole kind of food is medicine rhetoric and why we kind of have to be a little bit careful about it. Because I think on the surface, a lot of people feel like, okay, well, cool, but at the end of the day, you're just telling people to eat apples, like it's not harmful, right? But actually, it can cause a little bit of harm sometimes.
Yeah, I think it is this sort of distilling down of an apple or a vegetable of any description, whatever, or exercise, or it is healthy, but distilling it down into some sort of magical uber scientific property, and it just ends up complicating things quite a bit. It makes it really hard to make these decisions. You know, even if you just look at macronutrients, like we're told that, you know, we need to eat chicken because it's got protein, or, you know, all those kinds of, you know, messages that you get, particularly especially around food, I think. And I think food is like ultra popular to pseudoscience at the moment, if that's a verb now. I've created a verb. But, you know, it is very, very confusing. And it means that you're really struggling to work out what exactly you are supposed to do. I think with the food as medicine thing, you know, I know what people are trying to get at. That nutrition is important. Yes, it is. But I think calling food medicine does a disservice to medicine, and it does a disservice to food, because food is, yes, obviously nutrition and what we eat is important for our physical health. But, you know, food is social and it's cultural and it's enjoyable and all those other good things that happen when you eat food. It's energy. It doesn't have to be distilled down to its, you know, molecular structure in order to have value. And likewise, you know, the thing that worries me around that kind of discussion, that sort of food medicine tribe, is that it's a shorter step than you think it is from saying food is medicine to food can cure things. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you look at, and this is one of a couple of people who I will name and shame, the medical medium, not a doctor, talks to ghosts, not at all reliable information. So, you know, he does take that, you know, let's say celery juice, and turn that into celery juice cures, you know, this enormous list of diseases. And people are getting suckered in by it. And, you know, there are some studies to show that, you know, going down that sort of complementary alternative medicine pathway means that people, say, with cancer are more likely to die of their cancer because they tend to decline conventional therapy. And I think that's very concerning, that, you know, that's sort of the pathway that they're going down. And it's incredibly sad. I am seeing it more frequently, and it's really heartbreaking, actually. And it's kind of quite... It is heartbreaking, I think, is the word, because you know that they may have a shot, but they've gone down this completely different pathway.
Well, I think we've discussed on the podcast as well, is that it almost implies blame, that by not taking in these nutrients, or it's that person has not looked after themselves enough, they're the reason why they got sick. And I think when you're a vulnerable individual already, and you're susceptible to just buying into anything, you know, capitalizing on vulnerable people aside, it's it can be dangerous. It almost, the nonsensical part of pseudoscience, in that it could be advising someone cuts gluten from their diet, which is the knock-on effect could be weight loss. Where does that line then go before it becomes nonsensical, harmless misinformation to then dangerous misinformation?
I agree. I think it's a thin line. I think it's a shorter step than we think it is, particularly for vulnerable people.
Yeah. How bad is it though that when you said that you were going to name and shame someone for bad health advice, I got a little bit scared. I got a little bit nervous.
Did you?
Well, you think it was you?
I don't know. I thought,
oh God, she's come on the podcast. It's Mike.
That would be so terrible. I mean, I suppose we wouldn't have to release the podcast if it genuinely named and shamed me as a terrible.
Yeah, we do though.
But
it's fitness unfiltered, isn't it?
I know
it?
Exactly. I know.
Yeah, unfiltered.
Implications.
Yeah.
I was going to say, like, what the answer that you just gave reminded me of of one of my favourite quotes in the book. So would you like me to say it again in an Australian accent?
Yeah.
Well, you've set the precedent now.
I'm going to try and say it in a posher version this time. So I can't look at you while I do this.
Yeah, I'll look away. Okay. I'll look away. All right.
We live in a world where anti-intellectualism is at an all-time high. And people distrust science but put blind faith in a beautiful person with a smartphone and photo editing software. How's that?
It has the same little lift.
Halfway.
It has the same
I
lift as your Scottish accent, though.
I've
noticed
very
a theme
similar.
Here.
Yeah. How is it the same as Scottish?
No, because it has that little lift at the end. Everything has that little lift.
Yeah, that's what Australian people do, isn't it?
Oh, okay.
It's the intonation.
Yeah, like... no, like if I say, yeah, you should probably just help me. If I say no, it's no.
Yeah.
That's terrible. Oh my God.
Keep that in, keep that in.
But that's nice because it's like a, you know, you're saying no, but it's a positive at the end.
Yeah, exactly.
No.
There's
no.
A specific name for that. It's called, you go, yeah, nah. Means, no. Like, I'm going to string you on for just a second, and then I'm going to break your heart with the nah at the end.
I like that. I like it.
There you go. How to speak Australian 101.
Amazing. As the listeners can get more from this podcast than just an interview. There's like
is our equivalent, yeah, but no, but.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, but no.
Oh, yeah, right, exactly.
We have to hear, Nikki, we have to hear your British accent at some point in this podcast as well now.
Oh, yeah.
I am feeling quite nervous.
Okay, sorry. No need. I now feel bad that I've made you feel like I apologise.
No pressure, but...
No, it's okay. Well, because, like, Mike's actually done an okay job, so...
I know. We'll get Emma. And, we need to get Emma and Dan to do their Australian accents really as well, so that we can, you know.
It's all very stereotypical.
I think but I don't have a quote to say, so shame.
Okay. Well, we'll come back to this.
Should I answer your question in the meantime? I mean, there's that.
Yeah, no, that did, because that was my question. My question was going to, okay. So my next question that I was going to ask was going to be to talk about healthism, because this is a concept that I've not actually heard of that term before. So tell us about healthism and why it's and there should be a drinking game where every time in a health podcast someone says the word nuance or problematic, that's when you take a drink. But
problematic,
in fact, I think
it,
Josh and Alan did that in their podcast, so they actually had a drinking game for that. Oh, unless I didn't.
Shut up. Yeah, I'll try not to say that. But probably going to now because you've sowed the seed. Is basically applying this moral judgment to health and health behaviours. And Dan, you sort of mentioned that, you know, can become quite judgmental, that people, you know, think that they deserve what they get, or other people think that someone deserves what they get. So I see this a lot because I am a lung surgeon as well with lung cancer. Mm-hmm. People who are smokers and get lung cancer, everyone's like, well, you know, it's not like you didn't know. So I've now gone from things like, you know, smoking, you know, alcohol use, although, you know, I think we're both all from countries that are, you know, fairly lax with our alcohol use. But it does apply this sort of moral judgment to what we do. And it creates this sort of cycle of shame where you believe that you are, you know, you get what you deserve, which is not always the case, or that you can very easily manipulate your body and your health by what you do. And we sort of know that that's really not quite the case. You know, shaming someone into changing their health behaviour is just never going to work. And I think that a lot of the... I see this a lot with some of these fitspirational type people. You know, you just have to want it more. Like you're a fad if you don't want it enough, or you don't work for it enough.
Well, just try harder. Just try harder. Why just try harder?
You know, like you have no money, you have no time, you live in a neighbourhood where there's no facilities, there's nowhere safe for you to exercise, you don't know how to exercise, you've never learned how to cook, you know, you can't afford your food bills. But by all means, just get out there, just do something.
Yeah.
It's such a simplistic way of, you know, looking at it. And I think it reflects the demographic of people who are giving out this kind of information, which tends to be educated or, you know, relatively educated, privileged.
Just throwing things now.
A whole bunch of ads that make those people sound really nasty. that's what they're giving out, and it's very unhelpful.
Mm. I think like it's interesting because I think there's a real hierarchy of risk behaviour, because I remember having a debate with somebody years and years ago about how people were saying like the NHS shouldn't fund treatment for people with smoking related illnesses. And I was saying, but then, like, where do you draw the line on what is self-inflicted? Like, if somebody didn't look before crossing the road, or they were on their phone, do you then not treat their car accident? If somebody has a skiing accident, do you then not treat their broken ankle on the NHS because they knew the risks of going skiing? They knew that they could break bones. So why did they do it? If it, you know, and it's like, well, nobody would suggest doing that because everybody likes going skiing. You know, it's kind of, there's so many different levels of kind of bias when it comes to discussing that. And it does, like you say, actually, when you really question those beliefs, it does come down to a moral judgment. It's like saying that it is less moral to smoke than it is to go skiing. And that is, it's like, you know, wrong and problematic. Damn it.
It's problematic. I mean, there's a lot of nuance to this. I mean, sorry, you got a hat trick. You're right. And, you know, I think that we all see, and this is, I think, really problematic. Oh, I did it by accident. but, you know, when we look at celebrities, for example, you know, and or just pick anyone in the public eye, in the public sphere, particularly, you know, I think when we have, you know, like we do, Australia has a public socialized medicine as well. You know, my taxes pay for medical treatment, free medical treatment for people, you know, who have heart attacks or, you know, whatever. Skiing, not so many skiing accidents in Australia, shark attacks, but I was going to say spider bites.
I'm running out.
That's right. So we can't, even though we think we can, we don't actually have any right to be like, no, that's my tax money paying for that care. Therefore, I am entitled to comment on that person who is bigger than I think that they should be, or that person who is eating, you know, a burger. I have absolutely no right to comment on their health, their body, their anything, no more than they have any rights to comment on what I do. You know, and I think that this maybe it is something with socialized medicine, maybe it's just, you know, just people being bitchy in general, that we think that we have a right to sort of say you don't deserve care, treatment, compassion, humanity because of what you do not do.
Yeah, people like a moan, I think, but then, you know, the fundamental basics of civilization is looking after one another, in my opinion. But it's something that, but I think it's easy to lose sight of.
Like, if we're trying to look after other people and knowing that smoking is detrimental to their health, like, how do we then go about it? And I'm in complete agreement, obviously, that shaming them is not the right approach. But a lot, there seems to be, I find, in fitness at the moment, or in health more broadly, like a lot of, let's not do this, but what do we do? Yeah, or like, what's this, you know, nobody seems to be offering like a solution to that, like, let's not shame them, but let's do this.
That's in the book, you know, actually,
because I was gonna say. Yeah. I'd be interested, because, you know, we say shame's not a part of changing behavior, but then you look at things like cigarette packets over the years with the black lungs, you know, the tooth decay.
Yeah. Interesting, like, one of the few public health campaigns that's used that and leveraged that quite well.
Like the cancer obesity one.
Yeah, so that one, I know, so, you know, we heard about that here. And, you know, I know that the cancer obesity one got a lot of airplay. And I think this is sort of reflective, again, what I was saying about when I was writing the book. I was really torn by that, I think. Emma, like you're saying, you're like, yeah, I agree, you can't make people feel bad. But we do. you know, I think that's the million-dollar question. This is actually sort of weirdly sort of part of my PhD. So, you know, part of my PhD is going to be trying to motivate people on an individual level. But one of the things that we keep coming back to is that, well, that's all very well and good, but we can't, you know, we're missing all these other things. So I actually think that there isn't, this is from my understanding of what my work has taken me to, is that there's not really a one-size-fits-all answer. I think, though, we should 100% make it easier for people to achieve those health behaviours. And, you know, and the smoking one, you know, I think is really interesting because it's so different to what we've had, what we have with pretty much everything else. You know, we don't put, you know, posters up at bus stops of, I don't know, say, well, I don't know, like someone having a heart attack and say, you know, here's Joe Bloggs who's 60 and he never exercised a day in his life. You know, this could be you, Sean, I'm careful. And, you know, because people would never dream of doing that, but we do it with smoking and, it's, and you know, relatively successfully, you know, smoking rates plummeted until recently. They kind of stuck. But, you know, they really did. So I hear what you're saying. I just think it's a really complex and sometimes frustrating problem, you know, but we do need to offer up solutions.
Yeah, because we seem to get frustrated that there are no solutions, but then when someone comes up to practically apply, we then get outraged and upset that they've tried something.
So it's
well, that's the modern life, isn't it? We have to be outraged about all of the things.
I think it's interesting, like I think what the hard thing is everyone gets the message that's put out. So even with the obesity and cancer one, like you kind of want people who are maybe obese at the moment to see that and think, okay, maybe I'm going to make a change, that scared me enough to make a change. But what who you don't want to see that is someone who's got cancer and is struggling and is then thinking, oh my god, did I bring this on myself because I've been overweight for years. But equally, like you're trying to put out one broad message to, as you say, individuals who need to hear different messages at different times. And correct.
Yeah.
There's been a real cold.
That's public health, right? That's the problem with public health is that we're trying to do the most good for the most number of people, and you are never going to capture everybody. You know, try as you may, it's just not going to happen.
And I guess nowadays, sorry to jump in, Dan, but social media is the same, like people are putting out messages and actually sometimes they are really good messages for some people, but they're not good messages for everyone. And that's always a hard, and it you know, a message doesn't sound as good if you're like, but this is only applicable if you're, you know, fit X, Y, and Z criteria, and definitely not if you fit, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. Yeah,
it does make it very difficult, and this is what again I was going to ask about the you did a section in the book about choosing sides, and how what often ends up happening is people are choosing sides of an argument instead of choosing science, and it I've seen it a lot, like in social media. It's very, very difficult because once you've called your social media name like Low Carb Mike or, you know, Intuitive Eating Dan, you can't really come back from that without having all of your followers get very, very upset with you about changing your mind on things. So I think a lot of the time people end up getting stuck on a side and then can't have the nuance and can't kind of like accept that there are exceptions to the rule. I think one of the things you talked about is kind of the people talking about like body positivity and health at every size versus diet culture as a discussion, and how, you know, there's a lot of disagreement, but then there's kind of issues on both sides and a lot of bias on both sides and things, and then you talk about like self-compassion, and that's my question, is self-compassion the true hero of this discussion rather than thinking about body positivity or diet culture?
So I think I think to just go with the first part of what you're saying is that, yeah, there is this real you have to pick a side, and you know, come what may, you are going to debunk, argue, ignore everything that the other side has to say because it doesn't fit with your philosophy or your Instagram handle. I had this discussion just the other night. I should have called myself the wellness surgeon. I just completely dropped the ball. so much sexier. But anyway, you know, live and learn. But, you know, I think that if you take body positivity, now, one of the things that I think has happened with body positivity is that it's been co-opted a lot by pretty much anyone. You know, there's an Australian, she's like a very well-known personal trainer. It's probably not the one you're thinking of, but there is one who you know, sells diets and just these horrific exercise programs, and she's recently started harping on about body positivity. and she's the last person who should be talking about it, needs it, etc., and sort of fails to understand that it's not a marketing tool for her. It's a social justice movement, and definitely not meant for thin white women who have a lot of money. So I think that that's sort of the sort of co-option of body positivity, I think, is something that bothers me. When I was looking into this quite a bit, one of the things that, one of the big arguments is obviously body positivity promotes obesity. I think that's at all valid. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that came up a lot, just chatting with my friends and family about it, is that it became something else you could fail at, that you could, not love yourself enough, and therefore, you're doing, just as bad a job as skipping out in the gym or whatever. I think that it has validity as a social justice movement about trying to get people to be a bit more inclusive, whether it be looking at sizes or all those kinds of things. But, I don't think it's the answer for everybody. So there's this sort of phenomenon called self-compassion. So self-compassion, it sounds like you're sort of giving yourself, I suppose, a free pass, right? To be like, oh, I missed a workout, it's cool, whatever, don't need to do anything. But what it actually is sort of like, if a friend said to you, I slept in and missed running training this morning, which I'm saying that because that's probably going to be me tomorrow morning. So I'm hoping you guys will extend me some compassion in the morning. But
no, get up earlier, run.
Oh, Jesus. I was just about to say, you would never say to a friend,
exactly.
You're terrible.
Exactly, I know. I'm sorry.
It's Mike. That's quite all right. So there's sort of these facets to it, which is self-kindness. So applying that kind of thing that you would to a friend, and then common humanity. So understanding that, it happens to everyone, like everyone sleeps in and misses a workout, or everyone, goes a bit to town on a meal or whatever. And then being mindful. So being in that moment, just going, it happened. I feel a bit bad about it, but I'm not going to dwell on it. I'm going to, move on, and I'm going to grow from it. So that's the key, is that it's a tool for growth. So I think that that's sort of a more, it's a theory that's being explored in a number of health related fields at the moment, eating disorders. This is one of my PhD students at my university is looking at. So there's a lot of applicability for it, but I think it's a bit more of a kinder, more realistic approach for some people to kind of take away from that harsh, Dr. Mike style, no, Nikki, get up and go to running training approach to life.
Who would Fair have enough. Ever thought Dr. Mike would be the taskmaster?
I know. Terrible, isn't harsh. It? I was trying it out, word that and it didn't really harsh. Work, did it? Didn't really work.
No, it might, because when my alarm goes off tomorrow morning, I'll be so scared to stay in bed now.
Mike has shamed you into
it. I've shamed you into running. It's done you good. No, I'm joking.
Yes.
I completely agree with that. I think that's one of the fears that I think people have about, it's certainly one of the fears that I have about things is I often think that I've lost a lot of weight, I've changed my lifestyle, and I've done it predominantly, I would say, in a fairly healthy way. There have been times when I've believed things that haven't been true about dieting and nutrition and things, or ways that that I've kind of embraced diet culture in ways that probably in hindsight weren't as good as they could have been, but I've seen a lot of positives overall, and I sometimes think back to myself from 10 years ago, and I was all about excuses, and I accept there's a very big difference between me and society. Like I was a privileged person who is in a is educated in a good job, has access to all of the food and all of the exercise and everything, and I just wasn't doing it. So I was overweight and unhealthy for a very, very different reason to the, like, probably the majority of people. But there are a lot of people also who are in that position, who just don't really have much of an interest in their own health, or have a bit of a that that kind of invincibility complex that comes with youth, and who don't take an interest in it. And if somebody had told me all that time ago, oh yeah, diets don't work, you just need to love yourself the way you are because it's, you know, who you are naturally and all that kind of stuff, I'd have been like, brilliant, where's the ice cream? And this is kind of the issue, is that again, we're talking about universal messages that don't always apply to everybody. And I think that's why that concept of self-compassion is really appealing, because there is a heavy emphasis on finding solutions to why you haven't done that and how to help yourself do it next time and how to improve, not just giving yourself a free pass, like you say.
Yeah, absolutely. I know, I agree hard. And again, that was one of the things I did struggle with writing this, is that there were these moments where I was like, I want to be like, yeah, I'm going to go to town for like the next week and, you know, eat all of the food and whatever. And it's a really, if you're right, I think if you're in that, you know, mind frame, that is a potentially, you know, I don't want to say dangerous, but it's a bit of a maladaptive message. But, you know, we do need to, this is again about this sort of, I suppose, oppositional nature of the messages around, you know, diet, exercise, health, weight, et cetera. That is, I think going forward, it is about amalgamating these two sides into a common message that does, again, the most good for the most number of people.
And finding the right people to listen to for yourself as well. Like we've talked about this a lot on social media, but finding the right kind of people who speak the kind of language that you need to hear, which is quite, it takes a lot of self-reflection, I think, to find that sometimes, but often, you know, I think people often end up getting triggered by people who say things that make them feel hurt or whatever, and it's accepting that sometimes those people aren't speaking to you, they're speaking to somebody else, and some, rather than trying to call to ban those people from existing, it's kind of, you just have to accept that everyone deserves a voice, I think. And that's something that I kind of see. There's a lot of people who I think are doing a lot of good in the fitness industry, but who sometimes their delivery is different to how I would potentially deliver stuff, and different to the way that a lot of other people would deliver stuff. And I think even they get called out by people who think that isn't great. And I think that's the thing, is that we do need a little bit of a live and let live approach, I think, sometimes, because there are some people who need to hear those messages. It's just trying to make sure that they get delivered to the right people.
Yeah, I know this is like groundbreaking. You can scroll past.
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
you
know, I was just about to say similarly that it's quite possible to disagree and just not comment.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know,
newsflash.
Yeah.
Here's another. I think it's a revelation. It's probably going to change the world. If you disagree with someone, and particularly if you know them, you can talk to them directly. I mean, I know it's.
What, you mean you don't just have to do an indirect call out of them on social media?
What, not just a passive-aggressive post that's just timely?
And everyone knows exactly who you're speaking about.
Wow. I might try that sometime.
And look, I expect the Nobel Prize nomination to roll in for, you know, the Peace Prize for that kind of thinking. But, you don't have to. Like I say, I think there are exceptions to the rule, but generally, you know, if it doesn't speak to you, it's okay to just unfollow or scroll past, or yeah, if you know them, be like, hey, dude, what do you mean by that? Like, you know, that made me feel bad, or you know, you don't have to be so aggro all the time. Oh, that was very Australian of me.
Yeah, I like it.
I call Emma occasionally the Agatron.
Yeah,
when she's tired and hungry. Yeah.
Emma can be an Agatron.
We can sometimes have Emma. We can sometimes have the Sassatron. Sometimes we have the Agatron.
It's true. It's often when we record, we love them past all equally. Like 8 o'clock at night. It's not a good time for me.
That's fair enough.
Yeah.
No, I think so.
Yeah. Yeah.
Can I ask you, slightly detracting from that, Nikki, how you feel your role is in kind of being more of a champion for women in your industry? Because I see some parallels, especially with the fitness industry, and Emma, you'll probably agree, is that there are some awesome women in the industry that probably aren't being as represented. Where do you feel your role is in that, and getting more of that out there and being a champion of it?
Yeah, I think this is a really important role for women in any kind of sort of male-dominated area, and I think there's a lot of overlap. And you know, I know I go seeking out women in other areas or professions who I'm like, yeah, we're gonna, you know, sisterhood and all that kind of stuff. But I think it's a really important role to have. I think particularly in health and, you know, fitness, nutrition, all those kind of spaces. I feel like that's getting increasingly important because you need to be someone who's relatable. And, you know, if you look at the wellness industry, as a not so positive or good construct, you know, most of the providers and consumers in the wellness industry are women. And I think that, you know, it's really important to have relatable, credible, approachable voices in that space in particular.
Wait, are you saying that Gwyneth Paltrow isn't relatable?
I mean, look, you know, I mean,
I feel vagina connection, really.
Kindred spirits. Candles?
That's all.
Do you know what?
I do like candles, but not.
Do you know what is? Do you know that Gwyneth Paltrow was very briefly a singer? She did a film and she did a couple of songs.
Yes. Yes. What was that film?
Duets.
It was
was amazing. She had the most wonderful voice as well. Like these songs like sounded incredible. And I thought, wow, she could have been just a really cool singer, but instead we get Goop.
Yeah, she was in Glee as well, people have
told
me.
She was in Glee, yes. She was Holly, what was her name? I loved Glee. Such a musical fiend. I loved Glee. Betty Davis Eyes, she did a cover for that song, for that movie, of Betty Davis Eyes, and it went gangbusters here. Okay. Everyone loved it.
I don't think I've heard that one. I heard a different one. But
instead we have jade eggs and vagina candles and, you know, God knows what else. Gold dumbbells, apparently, because everybody needs to work out with a pair of gold dumbbells.
If you want to leave a legacy, why not leave jade eggs and special candles?
Yeah, that's a concern. But speaking of things that are that we don't like, spiders and chocolate orange.
Yeah, I've been a bit worried about this question. So I don't mind spiders because, you know, you just squish them, mate. You just walk up to them and you squish them.
Okay, we're going to have a big backlash from our vegan followers now, but that's fine. But how can you, like, I just don't understand. I don't understand the concept of being okay with spiders but not okay with chocolate orange.
I feel like, fear of spiders is probably a little bit more rational than a
I was at home this weekend and my mum said that she was trying to feed a spider some ham.
Some ham?
Yeah. She was like, what do they eat? And I was like, I don't know. She's like, I've given it some ham.
A spider's vegan? That's the question.
I don't know.
They eat flies, don't they? No, flies are...
Oh, they eat flies,
No, they eat maize,
They drink blood of flies, don't they? I didn't know... flies have blood.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I just don't... I'm really sorry. That flavour just doesn't belong with chocolate.
Okay.
No.
I just needed to bring it up. Now I feel I have closure. I'm going to ask you one more question.
No Jaffa Cakes?
No Jaffa Cakes. She doesn't like any chocolate orange flavoured stuff.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know.
Have you tried, when you have,
I believe the information you give out now.
What about
tainted everything.
Yeah.
What about crystallised orange peel covered in dark chocolate? Have you tried that?
No, yeah, who has tried that?
I'm trying to think of natural.
Where did you get that, Waitrose?
Potentially. Actually, Harrods do a really good version of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's a fancy chocolatier here that does that. Actually, they do. They do the most fabulous flavours of native is the word I was looking for, native Australian plants.
Okay.
Like a native plum and lemon myrtle and all these kinds of things that are, you know, native Australian, and you cover it in the most divine chocolate. is outstanding.
Okay.
So have you tried a Jaffa Quake
carb killer protein bar? Have you tried that?
Oh, if Nikki doesn't like chocolate,
I just am checking that it's been appropriately tried.
I've not even heard of that.
Exactly. I'm checking it's an informed decision.
Mike, you're going to need to send one over now.
I know, exactly. Yeah. It's definitely happening. I have one more question to ask you. You were in England recently. Did you have any good ice cream, and what was the best ice cream you had?
I didn't actually end up having ice cream, but I did have some excellent meals. I did have some excellent company. I would just like to say.
Yeah.
Big girl. I cried the whole way home. I was like, oh God, I don't want to be back here.
So where was the best meal that you had?
The best meal I had was actually lunch one day. The best food was lunch at a place that I cannot remember, but it was next door to the Daily Mail. So it must have been good because they have to keep that rabid crowd.
I went to the Daily Mail and I don't remember any lunches, but there we go.
Yeah, well, no, they didn't feed me, as if they wouldn't feed me. But then I had some other lovely meals. I had some nice steaks, and so hashtag not vegan. I had some good food and some good times, and hopefully I'll be back in Old Blighty very soon. So fingers crossed.
Excellent. Well, we will bring you a Jaffa Quake when you come back. That'll be excellent.
I will hold you to that.
Yeah, definitely. Right. Thank you so much, Nikki. That was really, really awesome. Really informative.
Thanks so much for your
time,
Nikki.
Really enjoyed that, and it's nice to pretend meet you. So thank you so much for your time as well. And I hope you manage to run tomorrow morning. But if you don't, it's okay.
Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Oh, we need a task, actually, Nikki. Please.
Oh yeah.
Here we go.
Yeah.
A task of the week
for our listeners. To our followers. So, our listeners.
Task. Okay.
Something they can post on their Insta story and tag us in.
Okay. So, one of the things that I think is really important is you want to be healthy, just do something. It doesn't matter if you're dancing around the house or whatever. So, I want people to go out or stay home and do something active. Even if it's just for 5 minutes, and take a selfie and share that.
Amazing. Thank you very much. And thanks for listening, everybody. And if you have any questions, please don't hesitate to let us know. Please continue to listen and download and share.
I feel like we haven't even said where they can find Nikki or
I was gonna get to that bit.
I thought you were finished.
Yeah, listen, download, whatever. And then and just before we go, Nikki, can you tell us where people can find out more about you, which will also be in the show notes, by the way?
Right. So you can find me on all social media at Dr. Nikki Stamp. That's N-I-K-K-I. And you can find me at drnikkistamp.com, and my book called Pretty Unhealthy. You can get it on Amazon, because that's how you say it over there. Amazon, not Amazon.
How do you say it?
Amazon. Yeah.
Amazon.
I'm going to say that to people just to tell them.
Amazon.
You can buy it from Amazon.
My friend was talking about conspiracy theories the other day.
Okay. That's so cute.
Oh.
Why are you laughing?
Sorry.
What? Conspiracy stories? What?
Oh, no, what's happening? Tell him, Emma.
What?
Conspiracy theories.
Sorry?
Conspiracy theories.
That's what they want you to think.
Oh, you're so annoying. I felt
that was
it.
So good.
I was cringing
so
happy
so
hard.
I managed to crowbar that in. I was so hopeful that would happen today. Thank you for playing along.